From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Adeline Baxter with this look at statewide, regional, and local news. This summer, the Alaska Marine Highway System weathered its first strike in more than 40 years. The fleet remained tied to the dock for 11 days while the state and largest ferry union worked through a federal mediator to hammer out a contract. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick takes a look at how it happened and what striking ferry workers achieved.
It was a sunny afternoon, and the state's flagship ferry, Columbia, was loaded with hundreds of passengers and cars preparing to depart for Bellingham, Washington. Then, with little apparent warning, half the crew walked off. Some picked up placards and signs and formed a picket line at Ketchikan's ferry terminal. The captain called the Columbia's stunned passengers for an impromptu announcement.
My name's Josh McGrath. I'm the captain on board. I just came on board today.
Carrie Martinson of Petersburg recorded the July 24 scene on her smartphone. The captain explained that the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific had called a strike. It was out of his hands.
So we are here until the IBU returns. We can't legally sail the ship without them.
That day, Martinson told Petersburg's KFSK she was trying to get her daughter to Tennessee to start college. She said the situation was fluid.
They've said that it would be probably a few days, and if it goes on too long, then they'll just basically cancel this sailing and go to the next week's sailing if the strike were to break up.
It took the state and IBU 9 days to resolve the contract dispute. The Alaska Marine Highway System didn't get back up and running until 2 days later. In all, more than 8,300 passengers were affected, along with more than 2,300 vehicles. Refunds cost the system upwards of $3.2 million. It was the busiest time of year and caught many, including Governor Dunleavy's administration, off guard.
It surprised me as much as it surprised the rest of Alaska.
Department of Administration Commissioner Kelly Chewbacca led the state's negotiating team with the IBU. So why did the ferry's largest union strike?
So, Jacob, I think that is something we have to go to IBU for, because I still puzzle over that.
It wasn't something that just happened overnight.
Rob Arnold works as chief purser on the ferry Malaspina and is a member of IBU's negotiating team.
The state just kept amping up the, you know, pressure on us, and we just had to do what we had to do with economic sanctions.
The contract negotiations predated the Dunleavy administration. The IBU's 430-odd members were still working off their last contract that expired in 2017. This year, they were asked to forego any wage adjustments. That would be up for negotiating next year. Both sides presented what they termed their final and best offer before the state declared an impasse.
86% of our members rejected that offer and gave us authorization to strike.
So what did the IBU win? First, it got a 3-year contract. The state had been offering a 1-year term. The union workers still have their pay frozen at 2017 levels, but they'll get 1.5% increases in 2020 and the year after that. From the state's perspective, the IBU agreed that its members would begin contributing toward their health plan in 2021. But they also don't automatically lose coverage during months when they're not working. The union also softened its stance on pay hikes. Chewbacca says higher wages translate into less money to run the system. Ferry workers are hourly. IBU members are only paid when they're crewing a ship.
So what we were really arguing for this whole time is we were trying to maximize the number of routes we could run so we could maximize service to the coastal communities and maximize the number of hours that these IBU employees could work.
There's some important context here. The legislature only appropriated $46 million to the ferry system for the next fiscal year. That's around $44 million less than last year, amongst years of cost-cutting. Under a draft winter schedule released last month, some coastal communities stand to lose service for 7 months starting in October. Arnold says the 11-day shutdown could serve as a wake-up call.
This is like a preview of coming attractions. So I think people realize, hey, this is what's going to really happen, and so there's more focus on the ferry.
But both sides say they compromised and reached a fair contract.
You know, they say the best negotiation is when there's compromise and people are not happy when they walk away from the table. So I think that's kind of what happened here.
Chewbacca credits the IBU's leadership in helping to end the strike. She says by the time they'd reached a deal, the tension in the room had lifted.
And that's very unusual at the end of an action like this, at the end of a labor dispute, to end on a positive note with the union representatives. And I was really happy about that.
There are still finer points both agreed on. The union also dropped a number of its demands. Members won't be able to pick which vessels they work on, and out-of-state workers will continue to be paid less per hour than Alaska residents. IBU members will no longer pay for hotels out of pocket. That's been an issue with the fleet's new Alaska-class ferries, so-called day boats, that lack crew quarters, forcing crew members to overnight in hotels between voyages, then wait weeks to be reimbursed by the state. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
This summer, a Juneau-based fisheries scientist received the highest honor given to early career scientists and engineers by the U.S. government. Of more than 300 scientists to receive the award, Elizabeth Seiden was the only Alaskan. KTOO's Zoe Gruskin has this profile.
So this is the lab wing. We have on this hallway lots of different chemistry labs, and I'll show you the biology lab where we run a lot of the energetic samples.
Elizabeth Seiden, who goes by EBET, used to spend a lot of her time in that biology lab. It's in Auk Bay at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Research Facility. As a PhD student, Seiden wanted to understand what happens to fish like pollock when the cold, cold Bering Sea gets a little warmer. A whole corner of the lab is taken up with equipment for the impressively named bomb calorimeter. Seiden would work for hours, exploding fish.
You dry the fish, grind it into a pellet, put it into this, and essentially blow up the fish pellet, and you look at the change in the temperature of the water bath surrounding it, and that converts to calories. It's the same process they use to figure out the calories in your food.
Seiden still gets to do some research, but these days she spends most of her time talking to other scientists. She puts together something called the Ecosystem Status Report for the Bering Sea. It's a big document, a couple hundred pages, designed to give the managers of Alaska's fisheries a well-rounded look at what's happening in that part of the ocean. So the report is about fish, of course, but it looks much further.
We also want to think about what their food source is doing and what their predator populations are doing and what the temperature is doing.
Seiden talks to climatologists, oceanographers, and all kinds of biologists. But she also talks to fishermen, and really anyone who's seen weird stuff. Seabirds washing up dead, or fish swimming belly up but still alive. Seiden asks all of them what they're seeing out there, right now. And then she tries to put together all the pieces.
And that's the fun part, I think, of my job, is to say, well, maybe it's not a one-off observation. Maybe it actually is really linked to all of this other stuff we're seeing, and we just haven't, you know, we just need to make that connection.
The report doesn't make specific recommendations on how to manage fish stocks, but it does try to tell a story. And for the last couple years, Seiden says, the story has been pretty dramatic. In the winter of 2017 to 2018, a combination of warmer water and unusual pressure zones and wind patterns meant there was almost no sea ice in the northern Bering Sea. It was, Seiden says, unprecedented. But then the next year, this past winter, it all happened again.
I said, we can't be saying unprecedented again. We need a new terminology. And so, you know, we have been calling it this double whammy of two pretty harsh conditions for the system to respond to.
Is that an official term?
We are calling it the official definition of a double whammy.
In July, Seiden received the Presidential Early Career Award for scientists and engineers. The honor recognizes her scientific achievements as well as her leadership and community outreach. Seiden made a quick trip to Washington, D.C. to accept the award, but now she's back in Juneau and looking ahead. Alaska's Fishery Management Council meets a few times throughout the year, but the final quotas for 2020 will be set in December. With most scientists wrapping up their summer research, Seiden says it will be a mad dash from now until the council meeting to pull together the report, to find the story in a sea of data. But she says that's the fun part. In Juneau, I'm Zoe Gruskin.
And nine conservation groups on Wednesday sued the U.S. Interior Department over its latest proposed land trade that could lead to a road through a national wildlife refuge in Alaska. The Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, near the tip of the Alaska Peninsula, contains internationally recognized habitat for migrating waterfowl. A federal court judge in March rejected a previous land swap. Residents of King Cove, a village just outside the refuge boundaries, for decades have been seeking a land connection through the refuge to Cold Bay, which has an all-weather airport and better access to emergency flights. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2013 concluded that a road would cause irreparable damage to the Eisenbeck watershed. Interior Secretary David Barnhart said in a statement last month, the needs of King Cove residents were more important. That's the latest from the KTOO Newsroom. For more local and state news, go to ktoo.org. I'm Adeline Baxter.